So Buddhism, or what it traditionally is known by the Dharma, which means something like the truth, the teaching, the training, has a very, very long and rich history. It's a little bit more than 2,500 years old. And it originated in India, spread throughout India, spread throughout Asia, all over Asia. And it's an incredibly rich tradition and diverse tradition with many different expressions in different countries, different traditions within different countries. And much of that has come west, has come to the west. If you look in our bookshop, you see, you know, a whole range of books on Buddhism from the different traditions, and you can see how rich and diverse it is. You've got Southeast Asian Buddhism, you've got Tibetan Buddhism, Japanese Buddhism, Chinese Buddhism, you know, so many ways of approaching Buddhist practice. And sometimes this can all be mixed up with local Asian cultures of various kinds, different cultures. And it can be quite confusing, even very confusing. And, you know, like modern life itself, there are so many options, so many possibilities. It can mean that we're a bit uncertain about what to do, what kind of Buddhism to practice. There's just so much on offer. If you go to any, you know, big city in Britain, I mean, there'll be a number of Buddhist centres, you know, all saying that, you know, this is the path, this is the way. It's very important when you look at Buddhism to return to its origins, to go back to the Buddha himself, go back to the sort of spiritual heart, the heart essence of Buddhism. Which means, yes, going back to the figure of the Buddha himself. He's the founder of what we call Buddhism, what we know in the West as Buddhism. Like I say, it's not actually Buddhism is a Western coinage. It's not the way Buddhism talks about itself. But anyway, we are sort of landed with Buddhism, so we'll use that language. Often the Buddha himself will be listed among the founders of the great world religion. So you have Buddha, Confucius, Jesus, Muhammad, etc., etc. It's as if he's the same kind of figure as the founders of the great world religions. But as far as he was concerned, and as far as Buddhists are concerned, the Buddha is very distinct indeed. Because the first thing we need to say, the Buddha is not a god. And he's not regarded as a god in Buddhist tradition. Neither is he the son of God, nor a prophet of God, or an incarnation of God. It's not, there's no sort of association with God at all. Buddhism is very unusual in that it's a non-theistic tradition. It's a tradition, a religion without a god, without a creator or ruler of the universe. This is very, very important to get hold of, and that makes it very distinctive. The term Buddha is not, in fact, a personal name. It's nobody's personal name. It's actually a description of the highest state, the ultimate state, of the highest spiritual ideal. And it literally means awakened one, or enlightened one. Awakened one, someone who's woken up from the sleep, the darkness of ignorance and unknowing, who's woken up to reality, to the way things are, and is living according to the way things are. And this state of enlightenment, Bodhi is the term for it, has two great aspects. First of all, the state of enlightenment, the state of being a Buddha, means seeing deeply into the true nature of life. Seeing deeply into the true nature of life, seeing it as it is, you know, without any filters, without any bias, seeing it things as they really are. And the result of that is liberation from all sorts of bonds of various kinds, all sorts of fetters. And at the same time, completely sort of fused with that, the state of enlightenment is a state of great love and compassion and identification with all life, which is actually expressed in deeds, especially the deed of bringing the means to liberation to, you know, to all others. That's the way the Buddha himself lived his life after enlightenment. He spent the rest of his time giving people a path, a way to liberation. There are many other qualities as well in enlightenment, very, very rich, all sorts of different aspects to it. And you could say that enlightenment is all, contains all the distinctively human qualities raised to their highest possible pitch of intensity or taken to their deepest possible extent. Enlightenment grows out of humanity, out of the best in human nature. Because it's very important to understand this, the Buddha is a man, is a human being, but he's not an ordinary man, he's not an ordinary human being. In fact, the term Buddha really is a completely different category of being. Enlightened human man, enlightened human being, is a different category. In the West, we're used to thinking in terms of God and man, or nowadays just man, you know, in the kind of materialistic atmosphere that we have. But, you know, very often it's God and man. There's a sort of, they're our categories. So we've got to start getting used to a different kind of category of being when we think about the Buddha, the enlightened individual. It's a different kind of category. Human, but human taken to its highest possible pitch, if you like. You know, we very often operate in the categories of, you know, being fallen man, and then there's the perfection of God, which is unrealizable. But Buddhism has a completely different vision. The Dharma has a completely different vision. The Buddha has a completely different vision. Human beings can become enlightened beings. Ordinary human beings, us, can become enlightened beings. We can become Buddhas. You notice in that dedication ceremony last night, that very important phrase, may my mind become Buddha. May my mind become enlightened, in other words. May my thought become, or may our thought become Dharma, which is reality itself, the way things are. And may our communication with one another be Sangha, spiritual community in the highest sense of enlightened people in communication with one another. So that makes it very clear that the Buddha's enlightenment wasn't just a sort of unique to him. It's something for everybody. We can all attain it. So this is the great discovery of the Buddha, if you like, and why we call him the Buddha, because he was the first person to discover this, to discover that it's possible to completely transform ordinary human life into enlightened life. And his own life is a great example of this. It's the great example in Buddhist tradition of transforming ordinary human life into enlightened life. And it's a story of great sort of heroic effort, great struggle and effort. You know, he left home, left his family, left his kingdom, left his country, and wandered, you know, trying to discover the truth of things, trying to sort of see into the nature of things, you know, just following his intuition to find the way things are. And it's quite a story. I won't go into the story of the Buddha's life on this occasion, but it is a very inspiring story. But according to tradition, he did gain what's called enlightenment beneath what's now called the Bodhi tree, the tree of enlightenment, at a place which is now called Bodh Gaya in northern India. And he attained it through intense spiritual effort and through deep and perhaps might be a few years. They find that they reach a point when they know that they've got to do something about the rest of their life. Their meditation reaches a ceiling, if you like, and they feel dissatisfied with that ceiling. Something has to change, you know, and what it has to change is that their life. They've tried all the tricks in meditation to kind of move things on. But actually, there's something they've got to address in their life. They've got to get to grips with things they're doing in the rest of their life. So meditation will induce change, a change in behaviour. Or you just give it up, you know, or you use meditation as just some sort of means of relaxation, which is fine if you want to do that. But really, Buddhist meditation induces change, change of behaviour. I can remember once being asked by somebody, look, I want you to teach me meditation, but I don't want my life to change. I just want it to make me feel better. And I said, well, look, I'm sorry, I'm not going to kid you that meditation, you know, won't bring about change. I said, you know, you might sue me if it, you know, your life transforms so much. So, you know, I can't teach you. You know, if it's going to, if you don't want things to change, you know, I don't want to get into that kind of trouble with you. You know, I mean, it could bring about the most incredible change in your life. So he went away and had to think about that. But as time goes on, as you train in ethics, as you train in skillful behaviour, and if you regularly practice meditation, and if you manage to get on retreat, as life and meditation begins to harmonise, a deeper change begins to happen to you. As you grow in awareness and kindness. And you might find that you're feeling, you know, very fulfilled outside of meditation, and you're behaving in a very, you know, your action is pretty skillful most of the time. And when you meditate, you actually enter higher, deeper states of consciousness. This is called samadhi, absorption. And there's many of these sort of states of very deep concentration and expansion of mind. They're intensely positive states, liberating states. You might find it's not as sort of dramatic as that, as sublime as that. You might find that you just have this sense of just your concentration going deeper and you know, greater expansion and loving kindness. There's just this slow, steady entry into samadhi, into concentration over a period of time. This is very positive indeed. You might even think when this starts to happen, it might even happen on this retreat that you feel this happens. You might think that you've really made substantial, permanent, irreversible spiritual progress.